This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and as the Occupy movement targets the 1% and then perhaps progressively the 1% of the 1%, the issue of corporate control and intervention in American society, processes, economics, and policy becomes even more essential, which is why we are very happy to have with us today someone who is an institution in analyzing corporate behavior. He is the editor-in-chief of the Washington, D.C.-based Corporate Crime Reporter. And welcome to 5 O'Clock Shadow, Russell Mokhiver.
Thank you, Rob.
Take a moment to tell people what kind of work you do chipping away at the corporate empire.
Well, for 25 years, I've been writing and editing a weekly newsletter, Corporate Crime Reporter, which documents the wrongdoing of major American corporations. And every week we run a question-answer format interview with a prosecutor or a defense attorney or an activist or a whistleblower or someone has something serious to say about the issue. And we've been doing that for 25 years, 48 weeks a year. And so we've been documenting it. I'm also an activist myself. And so I've been on the front lines of challenging corporate power from inside the belly of the beast, which is Washington, D.C.
One of the recent stories we've been quite taken by is your coverage and your final interview with the late Richard Grossman, leading activist in the issue of reforming corporate misbehavior and the structure thereof. In fact, you quote him in a recent edition of the Corporate Crime Reporter in your memorial about him, that Grossman said, "In a corporate state, law, culture, contrived celebration and tradition illegitimately clothe directors and executive officers of chartered incorporated businesses in governing authority. This is usurpation. A corporate state nurtures, enables, and expedites such illegitimate governing authority by violence enforced by courts, jails, police, and military force, and by historians. Less overtly ferocious institutions, for-profit and non-profit, routinely reinforce that reality." Can you tell us about Richard Grossman and how this meshes with the work that you do and that students of Occupy might do well to know?
Well, I first met Richard more than 20 years ago, right after I started Corporate Crime Reporter. And I guess I can say that the first meeting was like a slap across the face. He came to D.C. and it was challenging those of us who believed that we could deliver law and justice to the corporate state, that we could do this by exposing individual wrongdoing, by requiring the companies to live under the rule of law. And but what Richard, I guess Richard was as far away from us as we were from, like, say, the Chamber of Commerce. His view was it wasn't about the individual crimes committed by the corporations, but it was the corporate structure itself. And that we had been spinning our wheels, and he had been spinning his wheels. He started a group called Environmentalists for Full Employment, and he was with us pushing for regulation, for crackdown on corporate crime, but eventually came to the realization that by focusing on one crime at a time, we were losing the battle, and that we had to focus on the corporate structure itself. And every time we caught up with Richard, he would move a step ahead. So, for example, just a couple months ago, he emailed me and he said that he wanted to bring attention to two pieces of legislation that he drafted. One was a law that would criminalize fracking. He lived in upstate New York and was involved with the anti-fracking forces. Fracking is this practice of that's being used in the Northeast now to get natural gas from underground. It's harmful to the environment, and there's debate within the people organizing on whether we should regulate it or outlaw it. And Richard drafted this legislation that would criminalize it. And he also grew up in the anti-nuclear movement, and there was a very similar debate, and there was a split within the movement, regulation versus criminalization. So Richard was taking this hard line, but the other major law that he drafted, which was a shock to me when I heard about it, was he drafted a law that would criminalize the corporate form. He believed that corporations should not be given, that the shareholders of corporations should not be given limited liability. There shouldn't be perpetual life for corporations. They shouldn't be given these constitutional protections. So he emailed me, and I was really excited to write about it. So I dashed off an article, and I got another email from him. He said, "Russell, call me right now." So I called him, and I know when I get an email like that from Richard, he's not happy about something. And in the first article that I wrote, I called him the father of the corporate personhood movement. And he truly was. He went around the country. I mean, none of us knew about the question of personhood until Richard started organizing. He went around the country in small groups and talked to, he maybe did hundreds of these democracy school kind of things, where he talked to people about the basis of corporate personhood, that corporations should not be considered persons as you and I, natural persons. They should not be given constitutional rights of free speech and spend money as they wish and so forth, and that we should be able to regulate them without giving them those defenses. So I said he was the father of the corporate of the movement to challenge corporate personhood. And as a result of all of his work, there are now, you know, it's become a major movement to amend the Constitution to strip corporations of their personhood. But what he called me and he said, he had moved beyond that. And he called me and he said, "Listen, Russell, it's become a fetish. The movement to challenge corporate personhood has become a fetish. We have to challenge the corporate form. It's not enough to say that they should be stripped of their personhood. They should be stripped of this ability to protect their shareholders, of this ability to govern, to rule our lives, real human beings." And so, so he had once again moved beyond where everyone else was. I just returned from his memorial service in Woodstock, New York, which was Saturday. And to a person, people expressed this sentiment that he was sort of like the philosopher king of our movement to challenge corporate power. And he kept challenging us. And no matter how uncomfortable it was, and it was uncomfortable, because basically what Richard was saying is we were wasting our time. And he was a kind person, so, you know, he knew that it hurt. But he was coming from a place where he did very similar work. And he was challenging us to go to the root cause of our current problems. It's not enough to challenge fracking. It's not enough to challenge nuclear power. It's not enough to challenge global warming. We have to ask ourselves, why are we in this predicament? Why every time we challenge do we come up empty? And what can we do to make it different?
We have a situation with corporate operations where, if I'm not mistaken, Russell, a conspiracy of individuals chartered by the state is allowed to destroy water tables, to buy and sell so-called pollution permits with the various conference of parties and the so-called climate summits and such, poison the food, distribute carcinogens, spread nuclear waste all across the land, and what a radiologist called Goffman described as committing random murder or creating ill health or ill economics, other detriments to people. And yet there is no single individual or group of individuals who are held accountable under the corporate structure. How is that an accurate description of what you think is really the essential that you and Richard Grossman address? How do we get out of that licentiousness of recklessness?
Well, Richard was seeking that answer, and your description is pretty accurate, and we see examples of it almost every day. I'm currently in West Virginia, where I live with my family, and I wrote last week about a case here in West Virginia where 29 miners died after a disaster in the southwestern part of the state at a Massey Energy mine, and this was last year. And there, we called for a criminal prosecution of the company and the responsible individuals. We organized a group called ProsecuteMassey.org. We're trying to get a homicide prosecution of the company. And state homicide laws have been used against corporate crime. The most well-known example is when a Republican prosecutor in Indiana criminally prosecuted the Ford Motor Company for the deaths of three teenage girls in the 1980s when the Pinto that they were riding in was rear-ended. The crash itself didn't kill the girls, but the door slammed shut, the gas tank exploded, and gas leaked. I mean, gas leaked from the gas tank, and there were, the spark triggered an inferno that burned them to death. And so the prosecutor said, well, the company knew that there was a simple fix for this to prevent exactly that kind of gas tank splitting when it's rear-ended, and refused to spend the $20 to prevent it. Because if you added $20 times each one of those cars, it was real money. So he prosecuted this case, and you know, the company was really good at hiring, you know, the judge's best friend as the local defense counsel. I actually covered that case back in the early 80s and saw these shenanigans go on and how they manipulated the case and prohibited key information from getting to the jury, and the jury found the company not guilty. But it showed that a major American multinational could be criminally prosecuted for homicide. Well, we tried to get a similar prosecution here, failed. There was a federal criminal investigation of the company, and there have been about, I think, three or four reports showing recklessness that bordered on the criminal recklessness of the company, you know, past violations of safety standards and so forth, real strong evidence that would have allowed for a criminal prosecution. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. Last week, the company came down, the federal government, the Obama administration came down with something called a non-prosecution agreement. So, you know, they required the company to pay a couple $100 million, but they said, we're not going to criminally prosecute, even though the evidence indicated that there was sufficient evidence for a criminal prosecution. And this is what's happening now. You and I engage in reckless wrongdoing and end up killing 29 people. We're going to jail for life. Or in a case of a death penalty state, we'll get the death penalty. A major American corporation does it, and they get a non-prosecution and deferred prosecution agreement.
Well, Russell, doesn't it seem that the issue of personal liability from top to bottom of a corporate operation or a corrupt business or a corrupt business practice is indicated here? Because for the liability of this corporate conspiracy to harm people for profit is, it's paper money. It's imaginary penalty. It's something that does not impinge on the life of the actor committing the harm as it does on the victim of the harm. I think you know as well as I do that a motor company or any other corporation will do a calculation and see if the cost of litigation for harm is less than the cost of retooling. And if it is, they will proceed with the hazardous behavior.
That's absolutely true, Robert, but also there's two things here. One, there's the corporate liability, and two, there's the individual liability. So the federal government said we haven't closed out the case on individual criminal prosecution of the people involved with the deaths of the 29. But it's interesting that the corporations, the executives of the corporations want to protect the reputation of the company. No company wants to be known as a company convicted of felony manslaughter. They do not. And so because the reputation is what they take to the bank. If the customers start turning on the company because they see the company as engaging in criminal behavior, that's the end of the company. And so that's why they get this protection. There's like ironclad protection now. So major, if you see something called a deferred or non-prosecution agreement, if you see that, then, you know, put your money on, it's a major American company. It's a major American multinational company. They will criminally prosecute smaller companies. They will criminally prosecute you and I if we engage in wrongdoing. But major American multinationals get this safe harbor.
Russell Mokyber, the corporate crime reporter. One other question in context here. I certainly think that the issue of personal liability for executive decision making and perhaps right down to the clerk level is a more useful deterrent than this. And I look forward to following your pursuit of the unfolding of that issue. But I'd like to ask you, in this national moment, what is it that you think would be most useful for the Occupy movement, which speaks about the 1%, whether that includes the corporate person or not? What is the most useful understanding or tactic that could merge the Occupy movement with a genuine reform and bringing to justice corporate behavior?
Well, there are many things. Actually, the one I like the most has nothing to do with corporate and white-collar crime, with corporate structure. It's the financial transaction tax. And it's really a spectacular... The New York Times actually wrote a great piece about the financial speculation tax gaining momentum. And there's a great video linked at the end of that to... By this British actor who plays a banker, and it's great. You show kids, you show everybody this video because it brings home the point that a very small percentage tax on financial transactions will raise enough money to fund corporate crime prosecutions, to fund a healthcare system, and it would get us out of this bind that we're in about, you know, not enough money to do what we need to do. So that's one. Number two. I would urge people to, if they haven't heard of Richard Grossman, to read about him. There's a lot of videos of him online. But also, if you go to corporatecrimereporter.com, we have a link there to, and this was the last interview he did. I did not know he was as sick as he was. He passed away from melanoma. He contracted melanoma in April, and it took him in 6 months. So he called me. I guess he knew that he had a limited amount of time on this earth, and he contacted me, and he wanted to do the interview, and it's a great final interview, and you can read it online for free at corporatecrimereporter.com.
Russell Mokyber, it is a revelation to speak with you, and I commend you on your good work in dismantling or deconstructing this clear and present danger. Russell Mokyber, Editor-in-Chief of the Corporate Crime Reporter. CorporateCrimeReporter.com.
Thank you, Robert.
Sure. We'll stay in touch. Thank you so much, Russell. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight.